My name is Sandy Fahler, and I'm from the UW-Madison Oral History Project. Today is Friday, March 31st, 2006. I'm interviewing Chris Cruz Elliott, anesthesiologist and associate professor at the UW-Madison Veterinary Medical School. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
My first question has to do with your education, where you were born, when you were born. Describe your childhood, your early schooling. Talk about any family members, teachers, or other people that encouraged you in your studies.
I was born in Hillsboro, Oregon. I grew up in Forest Grove, Oregon, and there's suburbs of Portland, the major city in Oregon. And what was the longest
You don't have
question?
To tell me when you were born in this.
Yeah. We'll leave that blank. It was okay. A number of years ago. Anyway, I grew up in Oregon, did all my undergraduate and my vet school in Oregon. So I'm originally a West Coast person.
Did you go to public school?
I went to public school in our town in Forest Grove. And my dad was the technical director for a hardboard plant just outside of town. And my mother was an assistant to one of the faculty on campus at Pacific University, which was in my hometown. And then he ended up becoming dean of the school, and continued to be his assistant. So I had a pretty good exposure to the university life early on. I worked in the local vet clinic from late grade school, early junior high, all the way through till I graduated from vet school, intermittently during this, during undergraduate summers off. Let's see. Probably the one teacher through all my K through 12 years I had, my fourth grade teacher, Mrs., I think it was Huskell, one of those. Anyway, I remember, my parents keep reminding me of this because the neighbor's cat had died, and so she buried it in her backyard the year before our class started fourth grade, and then dug up the bones, and we spent part of our school year putting the bones back together and creating the skeleton of this cat. So that was probably my early exposure to veterinary medicine, my first anatomy class. Pretty much a farming community, suburb of Portland, so it wasn't a really big town that I grew up in, maybe 15 to 20,000 people.
So did you know when you were in high school that you wanted to be
veterinarian? I knew when I was in grade school. My parents sent me off to the local clinic thinking that I would be squeamish and turned off by it. And I came home and sat down at the dinner table and started to describe surgery. And I was told that perhaps that wasn't the best dinner table conversation. And my parents realized that was it. They kind of sealed my fate for me. So, yeah, when I went to school, when I went to undergraduate, that was my determination.
And say again, where you did your undergraduate work?
I did my undergraduate work at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon.
And why did you choose that?
Two reasons. One, it was the ag school in the state. The other major university is University of Oregon, and that's the more liberal arts school. And it was slated, at the time I started, there was no vet school there, but it was slated to potentially have a vet school there, which it ended up having. So it was the best place to go as a pre-vet student. And the other reason was my dad went there, and I probably would have been disowned had I gone to any other school, particularly the University of Oregon. But the major reason was it was the best place to go if you were pre-vet. So, and then my veterinary school was at Oregon State, but up until this past year, it's always been kind of a strange program because they take 36 students, which is about half to a third of the size of most vet school classes in the U.S., and you spend the first year at Oregon State. The second year of your basic science courses are up at Washington State in Pullman, Washington, which is in eastern Washington. And then the third year, you have 3 1-month rotations. One of them is vacation, the other is small animal medicine, small animal surgery. And then you move back to Oregon and finish out your basic science medicine classroom courses third year through summer, and then you start the rest of your rotations for your fourth year at Oregon State. So it's kind of a shared program.
Mm-hmm.
who was shared with Oregon, Washington, Idaho.
And it started out that way?
Started out that way from the get-go. And then, so all the small animal was at Washington State, which is in the middle of nowhere in eastern Washington. So I had a really good large animal background and training and was destined to do a lot of large animal stuff. And now I do a lot more small animal as an anesthesiologist.
Mm-hmm.
So, but now, as of last year, they built a small animal facility at Oregon. So it's going to be the full all 4 years at Oregon State, which makes it a lot easier. You don't have to move back and forth.
And then all three states finance it?
All three states were financing it, yeah.
Huh.
The Idaho students all went to Washington State, and then Idaho has a big, their contribution, I think it was the University of Idaho had a big feedlot program, so anyone that was going to do kind of production animal medicine, they went and did their rotation, their senior year bovine rotations there. So they learned all the feedlot medicine stuff.
Mm-hmm. Let's back up a little bit to your undergraduate education. Any special memories, any particular professors that you thought were mentors?
You know, it's funny, probably I had two favorite professors. One was a history professor, of all things, because I tried to avoid liberal arts type courses as much as I could. And he was just this phenomenal teacher. And so that, I mean, I'm sure he's long since passed away, but I would take another class from him in a heartbeat. He was just so good. And the other was the professor I had for organic chemistry. It was an incredibly difficult course, but he was such a good teacher. And he always he was really into the Peanuts cartoons. So he always had all his little kind of chemical structures. He'd like work a little Snoopy drawing in there or something. And then mentor-wise, probably, and that probably steered me towards my research career, was I did a honors program when I was in college. And so I ended up doing my honors research work with a guy who was actually a parasitologist and not at all veterinary oriented. And so I ended up learning to use an electron microscope. And I mean, it was pretty fun stuff when I was, for an undergraduate at that time. I mean, now they get to do a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, then when you left undergraduate work, you don't get a master's degree, you go right into vet school?
You go right into vet school, yeah.
Okay. Then what about, say again where you got your PhD?
So I got my PhD at North Carolina State.
Okay, but before that?
So I left vet school, and my husband Steve was living in Seattle at the time, working for the VA hospital up there, so I moved up to Seattle and worked for almost a year, my first year out of vet school, in private practice. In this, it was kind of when I talk to students about private practice, it was probably like the classic private practice experience. It was this guy doing, it was a mixed animal, so it was small and large animal. I was the one with more large animal interest. We did pretty much everything, and it was in a southern suburb of Seattle. It started out with three people, the owner, and then he hired two of us because he just had two people leave. So there were three people in the practice, and it started out that every third week you had a 4-day weekend. Well, about 3 months into it, the other woman that he'd hired quit. And so then the rest of my private practice experience until I left to go do my residency was for every 14 days I worked, I got one day off.
Wow.
And out of those 14 days, I was on emergency duty, I think, 7 or 8. So I was and this guy didn't believe in having pagers so I had basically, I would send Steve to the grocery store. You know, I had to kind of sit at home by the phone when I was on call. So that probably flavored my.
Now, how many years does it take in vet med school to become a veterinarian?
It's 4 years. So it's the same. The difference between vet school and medical school is that in 4 years, our students graduate from vet school and they're out there practicing, doing anesthesia, surgery, medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Medical school, they still end up going and doing a residency,
right.
and they choose their specialty. The people that choose to specialize in veterinary medicine, then they choose to go on and do a residency, but it's not a requirement.
Okay. Talk about your teaching and research experience in, I'm skipping ahead. You went to Seattle.
I went to Seattle.
Okay.
Was in practice for a year, and I had already decided when I went there, I had two really great mentors when I was in vet school. One is, and she and I remain good friends, she was a large animal surgeon, basically an equine surgeon. And to this day is disappointed that I didn't go into large animal surgery. And the other was the anesthesiologist at Oregon State. And that's what turned me on into being an anesthesiologist. So I knew when I went to practice that I was probably going to go back and do a residency and do anesthesia. So after a year in practice, we moved to the East Coast. Steve took a job with the VA in Augusta, Georgia, and I got a residency at North Carolina State. And so I started my residency program, and at that time it was, well, I think it might still be, it was a combined residency master's degree program. And so I got hooked up in the lab of the man who eventually became my PhD mentor, and started a master's degree while I was doing my residency. And it was supposed to be a 3-year program. I finished all my residency requirements, and he said, why don't you stay on and do a PhD? And in the midst of that, I had a job offer from Washington State to go back, to go there and be an anesthesiologist. So I had this kind of like, okay, what do? Do I take this job or do I stay and do a PhD? So I opted to stay and do the PhD.
And why?
Because I really liked the research, and I realized that long term down the road, it was going to be a better creative outlet that I would, as interesting as teaching anesthesia and doing anesthesia is, at some point you reach the point where you realize that you can only do so much, mm-hmm. and research there's more opportunities to be creative. So we wrote for, and I got funded as an NIH postdoc. So my PhD program, which was, I ended up staying another 3.5 years there. My PhD program was funded through NIH, and he was, at that time, had a lot of NIH funding. So I finished my residency, did my PhD, passed my anesthesia boards while I was in the midst of doing my PhD, so I got that all out of the way, and then I came here.
And how did you get here?
A position opened up here, and I knew just through, you know, 2 or 3 years of kind of talking to people around the country, I knew that there were probably only a handful of places that I could go as someone who wanted to do clinical anesthesia but also wanted to have a strong interest in research that would give me the amount of off-clinic time that I needed to develop a research program. And that was North Carolina or Wisconsin, really, kind of boiled down. And it was not a position in North Carolina at the time, although my PhD mentor kind of wanted me to stay on and be like a ongoing postdoc in his lab. So the position opened up here, and I actually applied for it and interviewed for it a year before I was finished with my way in advance.
Mm-hmm.
And they offered me the job, and then they said, can you come early? So I crammed through and finished all my research. And
so talk about your research then in North Carolina.
So in North Carolina, my mentor had developed this model to look at something called acute lung injury, which is something that's really common in people in adult respiratory distress syndrome, which is really common in people that are critically ill and hospitalized. And it's frequently associated with having a bacterial infection. And so he had developed an animal model using pigs, which are very similar physiologically and anatomically to people. And so that was what I did my research in. And so I still actually, even my work here, use the pig model, because it works out to be a really good model for human disease. So even though I was a veterinary anesthesiologist and trained as a veterinarian, my research has all been more oriented towards human health than it has. There's always been some benefit to the pig, because pigs also get lung disease, so some of the stuff that we do potentially can benefit pig health too, but
mm-hmm.
it's really all been, so it's been NIH funded, American Lung Association, American Heart Association. It's all been those pathways as opposed to kind of the traditional
mm-hmm.
veterinary. Some USDA funding for some of the stuff that was more pig health oriented.
Mm-hmm. So how was the interview process here? Talk about that.
I only had one other to compare it to, and that was when I interviewed at Washington State for the position there. It was good. You know, not the only thing was just a quirk of the system here, and they forgot to forewarn me. When I interviewed at Washington State, they just pick up the tab. They pay for everything. And when you come here, they don't do that. And so, fortunately, I had just gone to a big scientific meeting, so I had, like, some extra cash with me. So I get here, and we go out to dinner, and they go, oh, by the way, did they tell you? And they, of course, they're all embarrassed because, you know, somewhere in the process, and it was just a slip-up that the people here had forgotten to tell me that, yeah, you have to pay and then submit for reimbursement. So here's all these search committee people, and they're just sitting there getting red-faced because, oh, yeah, we can't pay for your meal. But it was good because they did a good job of setting me up with, to meet with some people over at the medical school that had similar research interests, and which I actually did end up when I came here collaborating with them. So it was, I mean, overall, I don't have too many interviews to compare it to. Mm-hmm. I was here about a year in North Carolina, tried to get me to come back, and so, because I did have a position. And I mean, I think my experience in vet school interviews is they're all probably about the same, other than the reimbursement thing. That was just, I don't know why that sticks in my memory. It was just so funny because it was like, I'm fine, whatever.
Yeah.
So,
but why did you decide to stay here and not go back to North Carolina?
That was one of the toughest decisions I ever made. And when I went up for tenure, I was like going, oh boy, do I regret this decision or not? You know, if they'd asked me, I moved here in like end of February '92 from North Carolina. So keep in mind, daffodils were blooming. I came up here to February, March, Wisconsin weather, and got here and went, what have I done? As much as I like winter sports, I was still thinking, oh, this is just awful. And of course, missed everyone that I knew down there. And so if they'd contacted me like 3 months into my position here, I'd probably said, yes, I'll come back. But I got here and I liked the research opportunities, and I had made some good connections for collaborations. And North Carolina made me a very good offer, and they did a good job here, you know, with retention, trying to keep me. It wasn't like they paid me a huge amount more, but they, you know, met the offer. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like it was, at one level, I think it was because it was kind of a challenge, because it's harder to get tenure here than it is at North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And another level, I just felt like I'd been here enough that I liked the area, and so I said, all right, I'm gonna tough it out. And I think I was only a couple of years into being here, so things were just starting to happen, and I had a graduate student, so it was a little bit, but it was tough.
I'll bet. Now you mentioned a little bit about this, but maybe you could elaborate. What had you heard about the reputation of the university here and the department before you came?
It was all good as far as, well, it was, I mean, 95% good. There was, the one thing that stood out was that it was a tough place to get tenure at, especially for someone, if you're in a clinical department where you have clinical responsibilities. I mean, I think that's improved since I've been here. But that the environment for research was really supportive. And, you know, it was funny because when I interviewed here, they made this big deal about how cross-campus, cross-department, et cetera, collaboration is encouraged, welcomed. People, you can walk into most people's labs with open doors. They'll do anything they can to help you if it's within reason. I thought, well, sure, they're saying that. But when I came here, I mean, that's really true. Hmm. So
that's good to hear.
At least that's been my experience. And I don't know too many people that, I mean, I tend to look at the positive. So I don't know too many people that had hugely negative experience. There's always going to be someone that's, you know, secretive about what they're doing. But for the most part around here, it's been really good to be able to go over to the medical school and collaborate with people, or now I have collaborations in animal science, and mm-hmm. that reputation was kind of hovering out there, but you know, you don't really know for sure till you get here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the people that I talked to, mostly other anesthesiologists, the people that had been here, I mean, I did talk to the people because they had two positions open at once, so I did talk to the people that were leaving to kind of find out, you know, why. And they were not necessarily leaving because the position, because it was bad here. It's just they were leaving to move on to something that was better for them. So. Mm-hmm.
And what kind of national reputation then does the University of Wisconsin Medical School have?
The vet school or the?
I'm sorry, the vet school. Okay, where am
yeah.
I? The vet school.
I don't know about the medical school.
Yeah, right.
Actually, you know, it's a fairly new school. It was quite a bit. I've been here a while now. I mean, it was a fairly new school when I came here, but it was already starting to get a good reputation, and I think that's continued to improve. I've been on admissions for the last 2 years, and then I was on a few years ago before that, and we get some really good quality applicants from all over the country, you know, out-of-state people who want to come here because this is where they want to come.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to go to California or Florida or, you know, and it's got nothing to do with they want to come to the Wisconsin winters, that's for sure. So I think, you know, they've built up a pretty good reputation here.
What is it best known for, do you think?
Clinically, well, that's a good question. I'd say our oncology program's fairly well known. And, you know, our clinical departments, I think we're probably pretty, there's probably individuals within our departments who are well known for their very basic science research that may not necessarily relate to what they do clinically and may not necessarily be associated with kind of the concept that this is a vet school. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the best example is the guy who's in one of our departments now who's done all the avian flu work, who's getting, you know, big national press and attention and grants and
mm-hmm.
and I think most people probably would not associate him with the vet school, but he's one of our faculty. So there's, and we have some good work in very basic science and neurology, looking at different myelin deficiency type diseases. So there's individuals that have a really pretty powerful scientific reputation, and then clinically I'd say oncology, I mean, I think our orthopedic program is good as well.
Mm-hmm. Describe the facilities in which you work. I see your office.
My messy office. This building, the kind of standard issue we're dealing with now is we've outgrown the space, both in the top, the third and fourth floors where all the offices and research labs are, and down in the clinic where really they're good facilities, but as technology's developed and we've added CAT scan and MRI and we're trying to add new radiation therapy modality, you know, as medical technology improves, then all these other options come up, and
mm-hmm.
so we're very space cramped downstairs, and particularly in a small animal hospital. And a large animal hospital, it's just, the building is, you know, I can't tell you how it was built in the 80s, and it's starting to show its wear and tear. So it's functional, and we get by, and we try and remodel and kind of work through it. And I'm quite happy. My research lab is great. It's just down the hall from my office, and so from that standpoint, it's fine. I don't have any complaints about what I do in my lab and my office.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you walk down the clinic, it's a little bit, sometimes you feel like, boy, we could really use an upgrade.
And where are the operating rooms? Are they on the first floor?
Yeah, everything's, all the clinical facilities are on the first floor.
Okay.
And then second floor is administrative offices, some faculty offices, not too many. So like the dean's suite and all that, and then all the instructional, two big instructional lab rooms and two large lecture rooms. And we're cramped for lecture hall space. We can't, for example, the lecture hall holds, our classes are about 70 to 80 students, so it holds, you know, there's enough room for maybe about 100 people in the lecture hall, seating wise, and that's it. So you can't have like a school-wide function in
mm-hmm.
our lecture halls.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hurting for that kind of space.
What's the facility on Mineral Point Road then?
The facility on Mineral Point Road is where there's some instructional facilities, so our some of our large animal laboratory teaching, so when students need to learn surgery in cattle or surgery in horses, we do it out there because we just don't have the space in this building. There's a small practicing dairy herd out there that they use to train the students in dairy management. And then some of the research animals, for example, some of my older projects, I used to house my pigs out there and then they would transport them into my lab for my experiments. But I actually now all my stuff is with the animal science folks, so it's just down the street of a different setup.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's why when you come in the elevator, there's a sign that says no animals on the second floor, because that's all administrative.
Right.
But third and fourth are...
Third and fourth are research. So there can be research animals up here, but you're not allowed to. You can't have your personal pets.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're a vet school, but none of us bring our pets to work.
This you already talked about a little bit, but if you just maybe talk a little more in terms of your particular work, is collaborative work encouraged? And you said yes, it is. And can you give me some examples of that?
I give you my examples, but the other examples, I'm tenure track faculty, mm-hmm. tenured. We also have clinical faculty here, what are called clinical track. And they don't have to go through the traditional tenure process because they're actually, as far as campus is concerned, they're not considered, quote, faculty, even though, you know, within this building, that's what we think of them as.
Mm-hmm.
They're considered academic staff, but they have a larger clinical appointment. So, for example, I do about 14 to 18 weeks a year in the clinic. Our clinical track faculty will do up to 26 weeks a year in the clinic. So they have a lot less time for research, and they're not able to develop, say, like a NIH-funded, for the most part. Now, some of mm-hmm. them have gotten into that. It's difficult for them to have the time to develop a really strong research, basic science research program. So they do a lot of clinical trial work. So something like, for example, some of the oncology faculty, we have a lot of clinical trials investigating new treatments for cancer, and some of that's in conjunction with the medical school. For example, there's a project right now where they're looking at a radiation therapy treatment, and they're using a dog model of cancer to investigate the effectiveness of the treatment using equipment that at the medical school that's also used in people. And it's funded by NIH, so there's those kind of, that's the advantage, I think, of being a vet school, is we have a lot of animal diseases that happen in people, too, and so there's a lot of crossover. So there's a lot of those kind of collaborations that happen.
Mm-hmm.
The orthopedic people in the building have a lot of collaborations with the orthopedic people at the vet school, or at the med school. And then my collaborations are with someone in animal science who's basically a nutritionist, and we're looking at micronutrient and macronutrient diet modifications and how it affects development of cardiovascular disease. And we use, because of my background with the pig model and with inflammation in blood vessels, and that's kind of where my research has always been, we're using this genetically high cholesterol pig model that gets atherosclerosis to look at these. So that's another collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've collaborated with some people at the med school in pulmonary medicine and in cardiology. Similarly, because of my background in cardiopulmonary inflammatory disease, kind of mixing that up.
Mm-hmm.
So.
You know, I sit here and I listen to that and I think, I was going to ask you the question, what's a typical day? But there probably is no typical day. There probably isn't even a typical week. Is there a typical semester in terms of how you divide your time?
So this week I'm off clinics. And I spent Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday doing surgeries on pigs over the livestock lab. We were putting these things called vascular access ports in so we can get blood from the pigs without stressing them. So it's basically... it's similar to the way that they do chemotherapy in people. They put these kind of long-term catheters in. So that was part of my research.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've spent the rest of yesterday afternoon, a good portion of today, doing stuff because I'm on a USDA grant review panel. So that's like another thing. Because I do research, I get tagged to do that by USDA. And next week I'll be on clinics. And when I'm in clinics... The fairly typical day is that we do rounds at 7:30 in the morning with the students, and then we start anesthetizing cases at 8:15. And ideally, we're done with cases by 5 in an ideal world, but then an emergency comes in. Or so when I'm in the clinic, I'm generally kind of down in the clinic all day.
For a week at a time.
For a week at a time. Sometimes I'll do 2-week stretches. I've done up to 3-week stretches, but that's pretty tough because I can't. I try to get up to my office or my lab. So next week will be an example of kind of where things are typically for me right now over the next year or two, because I have this NIH grant, is I've got Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I've got experiments in my lab. So I'll do rounds with the students, and then I'll run up the stairs and make sure we've got our pig going and make sure everything's going smoothly. And then I'll run back downstairs, do the clinical stuff, and then probably come upstairs a couple times during the day to check on how the experiment's going, and then have to come up at the end of the day to help with the end of the experiment.
Now, do you do classroom teaching too?
Yeah.
Of course.
And that starts, I don't do as much, which is fine with, you know, I kind of go back and forth, although I'm trying to revamp my lectures now, so to make them a little more exciting for me to give, because I need to update them. I do about 6 or 8 lectures, maybe up to 10 lectures a year, just kind of didactic, stand in front of the room and talk. And then the third-year students do a surgery lab. And forget where it was.
Well, you were talking about teaching.
Oh.
And we were talking about surgery, the way that the students...
Oh, surgery lab. Yeah, so we do our anesthesia, kind of basic teaching. I mean, the students do a 2-week rotation down the clinic their fourth year in anesthesia. That's a required rotation. But when they're just learning about anesthesia, we have 2 lecture courses, one in the second year and one in the third year. They're about 14 lectures each course. And we have 3 faculty and 2 clinical instructors. We have enough people that we can spread out the lectures. But then we have these labs that we teach where they're doing surgery. And mm-hmm. those are about once a week. I think we do, I can't remember how many labs. I end up doing probably about 6 to 8 of those labs a year. And then there's a elective course where they can learn food animal surgery, and another one where they can learn equine surgery, just basics. And so we do the anesthesia teaching in that as well. Mm-hmm. Those happen in the summer, so there's probably, we rotate that. So some years I might do 4 or 5 of those labs, other years I might do just 1 or 2. So I probably do more lab type teaching, because all the teaching I do in the clinic is all practical application. The students actually do anesthesia, so.
Okay. Could you talk about any students that you've worked with whose work or career stands out in your mind?
Well, there's been a few, but one of them is this woman, Tracy Gluckman. She stands out because, first off, she was incredibly persistent. She emailed me about doing a master's degree in my lab, and she was at the time living in California. She wanted specifically to come here, and she specifically wanted to come do a master's degree in my lab of all places. And
well, now how did she hear about you?
Just Medline searching research.
Okay.
Yeah, and she was working in a cardiovascular disease lab, just had her bachelor's degree and was just working as a technician. She wanted to get a master's degree, and then she was pretty sure she also wanted to go to vet school. So part of the reason she wanted to come here was to get to live in Wisconsin and go to vet school, but she really wanted a master's degree. So she was incredibly persistent. She was very talented and I can't tell you off the top of my head where she went to school, but she had a really good background. And so we brought her in, and she did a master's degree with me, and then she got accepted to vet school. And she had 2 really good publications out of her master's degree project, which was excellent. She got accepted to vet school, was, you know, bright student through vet school, and all the way through vet school said, I want to be a lab animal / primate vet. That's my goal. And stuck with it, did some externship experiences and summer experiences, and is now, I think she's at University of Washington, if I remember right, doing a lab animal residency and doing primate stuff. She was one of the most determined students I've worked with. It was amazing.
Now, what would she have done with a master's degree? Was it just to prepare herself for vet school primarily?
Prepare herself for vet school, and I think she was preparing herself for going off and doing... She was fairly determined that she didn't want to just be a practicing veterinarian. She wanted to be lab animal oriented, and so having a master's, having the research background was going to help her with that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay. Chris, you've talked about your research, and you talked about the... somewhat about where your funding comes from, how you got interested, and that you work with pigs. But could you talk in a little more detail about your research with the pigs?
Yeah. So what we're doing right now is the project that I'm currently doing is we're feeding pigs cranberry juice powder extract. And the pigs are either what we call normal pigs, so just your average... I mean, they're actually raised by the University of Wisconsin, but just a regular pig that, you send to market. Mm-hmm. Or these what are called familial hypercholesterolemic pigs, or what we call FH pigs. And they have a genetic predisposition to have high cholesterol. And
now, where do they come from? Are they
They were actually developed on campus here.
Okay.
And... So they're housed up at those and the normal pigs are all raised, housed up at Arlington Farm up in Arlington. And then we ship them down here and put them on our feeding trial. And we're looking at what feeding cranberry juice powder extract does to the function of their blood vessels. So people and pigs with high cholesterol have blood vessels that don't relax very well and don't function very well, in addition to the fact that they get atherosclerosis. And our preliminary work, we found that if you fed them cranberry juice powder, their blood vessels functioned better, more like a normal pig's blood vessels. So that's what we're looking at. We're looking at in conjunction with the model that I've had in my lab, where we've used a bacterial product called lipopolysaccharide to induce kind of an acute inflammation in the blood vessels. So we're trying to look at that combination.
Mm-hmm.
And then some other stuff that we've been working with some other companies that produce kind of more nutritional supplement type things for people to take that might have modifying effects on cardiovascular disease. So the guy that I work with in animal science, Jess Reed, he's more the kind of nutritional end of that, and I'm more the kind of physiology, pathophysiology end of it. So
when you say working with companies, are they funding the research then?
We just got a grant. It's called an Industry Economic Development Research Grant. It's funded by the university, but you have to have matching funds from a company, because the idea is to create technology transfer to that company. And there's a company in Wisconsin called Standard Process that makes nutritional supplement products. And so we've got that funded to work with them to develop some of the stuff that we use in the pig model so they can use it to test their products. So that's a kind of... And then Ocean Spray is providing us with the cranberry juice powder. There's another company, Palm Wonderful, that makes all that pomegranate juice,
mm-hmm.
and Jess does some work with them, mostly looking at the components in... He does a lot of... mass spectrometry, HPLC, kind of chemical analysis. But we're also trying to work with them to they're kind of modestly interested in the pig model to look at mechanisms of how pomegranate juice improves cardiovascular health. So hopefully we'll be doing some stuff with them too.
Can you talk a little bit more? You've talked about this, I think, to somewhat, but on the fundraising aspects of your job. Is that
the grant writing part?
Is that what it is? It's primarily grant
writing.
Okay.
It can be frustrating, to put it mildly. Yeah, it's one of those things. Funding is tight everywhere. My lab would shut down if I wasn't getting outside funding. There's no in-house funding to keep my research going or keep any of, keep the people that work in my lab paid. I share it. My lab tech is actually... the radiation therapy project I was talking about, she's actually funded off that. I share it with someone else.
Yeah.
And then I fund some other people that we share. So, and just about the time you get one grant, so my current NIH grant's good for 2 years, and this IEDR will start in July, and it's good for, we're already talking about writing some more grants. So it's kind of this constant battle, finding enough time to write. You know, in the meantime, I've got to write up the papers associated with the research we're doing. So it's a lot of writing, and you submit something and you need to have preliminary. So you need to have some of the work already done to prove that you're going to be able to do it. So preliminary data. So you're always kind of finishing a project, starting another one before you're trying to be ahead of the game.
So what does a company like Ocean Spray expect to, what do they need to decide that they want to give you the cranberry powder?
To be honest, can't remember all the exact details, but we're funded by a branch of NIH called the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine. There's different centers in NIH. And NCAM contracted several years ago, they had this big push to look at cranberries in health and disease.
Okay.
And so one of the things was to have someone produce a standardized product. Because if you can imagine, there's Ocean Spray and there's other cranberry companies out there making product. And the problem is, when you go to test them, you might test one person's product and it works really well and another person's doesn't. And how long has it been stored? How has it been processed? So one of the things, NCAM wanted to explore how these things functioned, but they also needed, if they were going to fund projects, they needed a source that was standardized.
I see.
And Ocean Spray was involved in creating that product.
Okay.
Interestingly, for another company, I don't remember exactly how the whole thing worked.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we were able to get product from them. They're not really necessarily funding the NIH thing. They're kind of, to some extent, I mean, they are at one level because they're giving us the product. We're not having to, so they're contributing to.
Oh, that's interesting.
Work. Yeah.
Okay. What are the most significant developments in your field of study?
What you have to understand is I've been working in the kind of lung injury sepsis field for a number of years, and then I switched into this atherosclerosis field and in the nutritional product field. I think the developments have been that over the last several years, people have actually started to look at these kind of micronutrients more closely and recognize that, you know, the red wine thing or cranberry, that yeah, there is a benefit here, and there's actually research money getting put towards investigating that, as opposed to just going, well, yeah, who knows if acupuncture is going to make you healthier or whatever. So I think there's been enough good, solid science behind, yes, some of these things do improve health, that now there's kind of the ball's rolling to investigate them more. The other development is there was a big stretch of time where everyone was really into molecular biology and, you know, what's the DNA sequence or RNA sequence and protein that's produced. And so people like me who are whole animal physiologists, there was a lot less interest in that. Well, now things have kind of come full circle. And so now what's happening is everyone's starting to realize, well, that's great. We need the information on the molecular part of it, but we also need to know what's happening in the whole person, whole animal. So things have kind of come full circle, and now there's a bigger push to look at some of these animal models of disease and really get a better handle on. So you identify the gene that gets turned on. What's that mean in the person who's got cardiovascular disease?
Sure. Would you talk a little bit about your involvement in committee work, outside activities, other campus activities, if you've ever been involved in faculty governance, service activities? What do you enjoy? What do you wish you could give up?
It's kind of a double-edged sword when you say you're going to be on a committee, because it's big. Some of them are big time sink. Like, I just came off of admissions. I actually had another year left on it, and I just said, I've got way too much. Can I please come off of it? Because it's very rewarding at one level, because you get to choose the incoming class, and you get to see who these people are and, you know, have some input. But at another level, it's a full week of reviewing files and another 2 to 3 days of selecting the class. So it's a big chunk of time.
Sure.
Those are always hard. Campus committee wise, I'm on the Biological Sciences Divisional Strategic Planning Committee, and that's actually been, well, I don't know, we'll see, because now I'm going to be the chairperson next year.
Oh boy.
Yay. It's been good because I get to see kind of what's going on around campus, and it's the Biological Sciences Division. So the vet school, because we're a professional school, we're a little different. We don't have much undergraduate education responsibilities, and so it's nice to see some of what's going on in undergraduate education, because those are the kids that come to us for
sure.
Their advanced training.
Now, how do you get on that committee?
You get elected.
Okay. But you have to agree to run before you get elected?
Right. And, yeah, I'm sometimes not real smart. No, I decided I wanted. Yeah. I decided, and that committee, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of people interested in it. We struggled to get people to run to be on the committee. But it was one, I was kind of curious about what's going on campus. I didn't have a real good clue as to what that committee did. I mean, I had a kind of an idea, but I thought, boy, it's a good way to ease into a little more campus involvement. I've done some other kind of campus, every 5 years the deans have a review, and that's it's an in-house committee, but it's appointed by the chancellor. So I was on that committee a couple of years ago. Some of them can be rewarding and some of them can be kind of painful.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about, you said that you're on a panel. In fact, you're chairing a panel, federal panel
For USDA. So I'm chairing a grant review panel for USDA. And what happened was, thank you to my PhD mentor. Four or five years ago, I was contacted just to be a reviewer on that panel, which meant be one of 12 to 14 people that serve on the panel. You get 10 to 12 grants to review, and then you fly to DC and participate. And I did that for 2 years, and then they asked me to chair the panel, which means one trip to DC in the fall for orientation and to kind of meet with the national program leader for that panel and decide how you're going to do the whole, set the dates and everything, and then basically making a lot of phone calls and emails around the country trying to get people to serve as panel members. And then once you get that done, then you have to assign all the reviewers, which I just finished doing that this week. And then we'll meet in DC for almost a week. For the panelists, it'll be a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, but I have to fly in on Sunday to get ready for the meeting. So that's a week out in DC with the panel meeting.
And then you make a recommendation, or do you have to make decisions?
We make decisions. So you walk out of that panel meeting having decided who's getting funded and who's not.
How many dollars are we talking about?
You know, off the top of my head, I can't tell you. But what I can say is that I think in the past several years I've been on that panel, out of around 50 to 55 grants submitted, we fund probably maybe 6. That's pushing it. And I think it's realistically 4. There's not a lot of money. It's really hard when you're on the panel, because you see a lot of grants that you want to fund and there just isn't the money to fund them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up having to turn people away.
And then who gets to tell those people that are turned away?
The national program leader gets to do that.
Oh.
The panel members are kept confidential. Mm-hmm. The national program leader is the person in charge at USDA, and then I'm not kept confidential either, so they can, no, last year no one called me, so,
mm-hmm.
And it could be the option, he gives me the option of me making the kind of congratulations, you got funded phone calls, but I figure they always get the kind of, why didn't I get funded phone calls, so I let them be the good news bearer too, so they get a little bit of warm fuzzy there.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea. Would you talk a little bit about the climate for women on the Madison campus, just your own personal opinion? Does it help or hinder in the participation, or how does it help? Does the climate help women advance on this campus? I'll stop there, and then I've got another more basic question.
Some of it is, in my opinion, is think we're a little sheltered in the vet school, because I think there's, although then when I think about how many women we have in administrative positions, we don't have that many, but I guess I haven't experienced that it's a real discriminatory climate. On the other hand, I've talked with enough people that have had issues, so I have this kind of mixed view of, for me, it's been fine.
Mm-hmm.
For other, I know there are people that have had problems, and I think some of it is that we're, the vet school is kind of, it's a professional degree program, and it's a little separate from, and it's a fairly new school, so there were a lot of younger faculty that came in here, and I think, because I know around the country, if you go to some of the older vet schools, they have the same kind of issues that you hear might hear about in older departments on campus. But I think because the vet school's newer,
mm-hmm.
we probably don't see that as much. That's my best guess. And, you know, maybe I'm just completely naive. I do tend to, you know, like I walk down the clinic and I have no idea what the gossip is, because I do tend to kind of walk around and I've got enough on my own plate that I don't
sure.
really pay too much attention. But it hasn't negatively impacted me to any major extent.
Mm-hmm. And what about the students? Are there more female?
Well, yeah, that's
school
the
students?
Other thing. We have our, in fact, on admissions, we're searching for a few good men. I mean,
huh.
it's, we have the majority of students are women, and it continues to be, I mean, actually men are a minority. So,
so this question of how do you get more girls interested in science really isn't a problem in the field of veterinary science?
No, except that you have to look at most of those people are going out into private practice, and while veterinary medicine is a science, it's not, I mean, it's, they're not going into the pure kind of basic sciences.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side is, you know, a certain percentage of those students go on to do residency programs, plus or minus, you know, master's degree, PhD. Although we're having more trouble attracting men or women into academic veterinary medicine because they can make more money out in private practice these days. But so we're generating more women that potentially would then come and hopefully come back into academics.
But what now, what was your undergraduate major?
General science. I was so, I put all my eggs in one basket, and my parents just kept shaking their head. I was so pre-vet oriented that I essentially majored in the courses I needed to take to get into vet school.
Okay. Well, now these young people that apply to vet school here, if you were on the admissions committee, are they mainly science students?
Yeah, although, you know, we get someone who's was a lawyer, or we get a smattering of people who have had one career and now are changing careers.
Oh,
computer science, lawyer, those, you know, I mean, I think maybe we've had an MD apply. So you get kind of that. You get a little bit more of that. And we are getting more students. And if I talk to any undergraduate students, which is pretty rare unless it's just someone that knows that this is what I do, and, you know, children of friends or whatever, I always tell them to get a little more liberal arts education than I had, because I think they come in a little more well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we want them to have science, but most of them, I mean, those are required courses, so.
Yeah. We have to have that bedside manner, right? As a
right.
vet as well as a...
Yeah.
Discuss the professional organizations to which you belong, and are you involved in them heavily in your spare time?
In my spare time.
Whatever that is.
Well, I'm board certified as an anesthesiologist, so I belong to that,
mm-hmm.
and I've been on the credentials committee, so when you finish your residency, you submit your credentials to see if you can sit and take boards and become board certified. So I've been on the credentials committee, and I got suckered in by my former residency / PhD mate. He was like a year behind me. He did his residency at NC State and his PhD in the same lab, so we're really good friends. He's now president of our organization. He said, gee, would you chair? So now I'm chair of the credentials committee come July 1. Not real smart sometimes. so I'm involved there. I rarely go to the national meetings though, because my research is so remote from anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
I try and go, and I'll probably try and go, not this year, but maybe the year after. The money I have for travel is limited, and it comes off my grant right now, and so I need to spend that to go to scientific meetings related to my research. Beyond that, I haven't been, like some people have been. I know I'm in the American Physiologic Society, and I know a couple people in this building that are fairly active, and I just haven't been.
Mm-hmm.
I go to the meetings and I present, and I don't, as far as governance stuff, I haven't.
And where does publishing fit into all your time? I mean, I know you mentioned not only do you have to write the grant, do the research, and then you have to somehow get the papers written. And
it needs to fit into more of my time right now, because I'm sitting on like 3 or 4 papers that need to get finished and written and published. And one is a former resident that dropped the ball on a project that we did, and so now I've got to write his paper and get it published. The other is the preliminary cranberry juice stuff that we did. I need to get that published, and then just a couple other projects. So
just a couple.
In the meantime, in fact, we sat down yesterday, Jess and I sat down and talked about submitting a grant by June 1. I said, I'm going to be better served by trying to get some papers written. So I'm just, it's hard, because some people can walk up in their office in over 30 minutes, write a paragraph. I can't do that. I have yet to be able, it's just not how I function. I have to block out time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm in the middle of doing all these experiments and surgeries on my research animals, and then trying to find a chunk of time where I can. So it won't be next week, because I go back on clinics. And I got to start reading 50 plus USDA grants.
Now, my last question about your research, your work on campus, is honors and awards. Can you talk about those? I'm looking at your plaques up on the wall here.
I haven't had too many in the last few years, because once you become faculty, when I was doing my PhD, I presented and had, I kind of came into this with a few honors and awards. I'm never going to be, I teach and I like teaching. I'm not going to win teaching awards, because my lecture style is pretty dry and boring. And I do research and I love doing research. I'm probably not going to win, there's some in-house research awards, but I'm reluctant. I've gotten to the point where my lab reached kind of critical mass, where all I was doing was administrating graduate students, and I like spending more time physically in my lab, so I kind of walk that fine line between having enough of that happening to where someone would say, oh, wow, I like teaching graduate students, but I don't want to have a whole plethora of them, because then I don't feel like I get too diluted out.
Okay, Chris, life after work.
Yeah, when I get home.
Describe your family, and how do you balance work and family?
Well, let's see. It's pretty easy to balance work and family in my house, because we have no children. And my husband travels a lot in his job as a roller coaster engineer. So, which works, works well. Usually if he's home for a month or so, I'm kind of like, so when's your next job? Aren't you leaving soon?
Well, you must have pets.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's see. We have right now 3 cats and 2 birds. I don't have a horse anymore, and I don't have a dog anymore. Much as I'd like to have a dog, my husband has put the no way, given that I'm frequently here 14 plus hours when I'm in the clinic. He's, I think rightfully so, said that doesn't fit your lifestyle. So there isn't much life after work. It's usually before work.
Okay. Well, what do you do for fun and relaxation when you're not working?
That's a loaded question. So, for fun and relaxation, I get up at 4 a.m. and work out and train to do Ironman triathlons. Or in the winter, I teach downhill skiing.
And that those are things you've been interested in since you were a kid?
Skiing I have done since I was probably about 12 years old. 11 or 12 years old, and I've taught skiing since I was in high school. And so, as if I don't get enough teaching in this building, I go do teaching on my free time. And it's just a different outlet for teaching. triathlon I've done since I was in North Carolina. I started doing that, not Ironman, but I started doing triathlons when I was doing my residency and PhD back in the mid-80s.
Now, did you do that to relax? Tell me what's fun about that.
It's great stress relief. Yeah. It's just a nice mindless. And actually, a lot of the times, I mean, I try to not do this, but if I'm out for a run or a ride or a swim, I try to not think about work. But sometimes it's a great way, if I'm trying to write a paper, it's a great way for me to kind of mentally sort through some stuff. So, most people wouldn't call it relaxing, but I find it to be.
Well, I just realized I have one more question that I should have asked earlier. It's not on my sheet, but I know, tell me about some of the more interesting cases you've been involved in the clinic, because I know that there have to have been some.
Let's see. Well, yeah, there's some that stand out. Let's see. Most of them have always been the ones where I just about got killed by something. let's see. We did, and this was in my residency, we did cataract surgery on an ostrich.
Oh, my gosh.
That almost ended my career at an early stage because they're not very nice creatures.
No, they're dangerous, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very dangerous. And we weren't, and this was at North Carolina State, and we weren't at all, not that we are here either, we weren't at all really set up to handle. So we had it in a equine stall, and the only thing that saved us was the thing was blind. So my residency mentor and I were in this stall with people holding the door shut, mind you, so we're like trapped as we're trying to get this thing, you know, poke it with a needle and make it go to sleep. So that was, and then of course when it woke up, you know, when it finally started moving around, we basically just shut the doors to the recovery stall and, you know, let it do its thing. It survived too. That was very strange. I've done a giraffe multiple times. One giraffe multiple times. It was a baby giraffe with fractured legs. Let's see.
Here at Matt?
No, that was at North Carolina. Here, let's see. Well, we do kidney transplants in cats. Those are always, I mean, actually, from an anesthesia standpoint, they're not that exciting, but, I mean, it is kind of an amazing thing that we're doing that. We get cranes from the Crane Foundation. That hasn't always been the most rewarding because they're very difficult to anesthetize. They usually come to us with some major, like, broken something. So it's really nice to say, gee, you know, I had this unsuccessful, it died under anesthesia of something that's only one of how many in the world.
Yeah.
But we've had some success stories there too, I should.
Where's the closest vet?
The ones that I've just about gotten killed on.
Yeah. Probably a good thing you want to forget too. So you were talking about you get patients up from all over.
From all over. We get people that they come here instead of going to the vet school in Illinois or Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that's because we offer something that those schools don't. Sometimes it's just they want to come to Wisconsin. The transplant cats, we've had a kidney transplant cat that came from Singapore. The owner sent it all this way to have a kidney transplant. That's probably the longest distance of anything I can think. We get the transplant cats come from all over the country because they're only, us, North Carolina, Davis, I think that's it. I think there's only three or four schools doing transplants.
There aren't that many vet med schools in this country, are
there's
there?
There's like 20, I should know this, 26 or 27 in the U.S. and Canada. Not many.
Yeah. And how many students in a typical year that
we
students?
Take about 80. You know, there's 70 to 80. I think Colorado maybe has like 100. And Davis maybe, they're over 100, I think. But that's for all of California. Well, there's now two vet schools in California. There's a kind of private one in Southern California. But that's, when you think about the population in California, or, you know, New York's another example. I don't know how many students Cornell takes. I don't think there's anyone that takes, like, 200. I mean, it's all, they're all, I think North Carolina's probably around 80. Oregon State, even though they now have the full program, I think they're only taking 50 or 60. So, yeah, there's not a lot of positions. We get 1,500 to 2,000 applications every year. You know, and that's, I don't know, it's 250, 300 in-state. The rest of it's all out-of-state. So.
Well, I don't have any more questions. Is there anything you'd like to add that we haven't covered?
I think we've pretty well covered my life and time at the university.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
For taking the time to do this.
Glad to help.